Hello and welcome to another episode of The Old Lady Speaks on Black and White and Red All Over. This is your host, Danny, coming to you for episode number 23, the Marco Borriello episode. And who can forget Marco Borriello scoring actually one of the most important goals of the early Scudetto run. So thank you, Marco Borriello. This week's episode, obviously, we've got a whole lot to talk about as compared to last week when it was an international break. We've got a good game against Dynamo Kiev coming off a not-so-good game against Crotone. And let's start there, and let me bring in the guys first. Sam Lopresti. Hello, Sam.
How are you today, Danny?
I'm doing all right. We've got Chucks. Hello, Chucks.
Yeah, good evening, lads. Marco Borriello probably had the best haircut, cleanest cut haircut in a typical Italian fashion.
He is a very handsome man. We will definitely
between him and Alessandro Matri, we had some damn good hair that year.
Get that commercial, Head and Shoulders. Get that commercial.
Speaking of a guy with a nice head of hair, Sergio Romero. Hello, Sergio.
Thanks. I appreciate the compliment there. It's fun because that Borriello comment, like, it makes you think how many like remember that guys we've had like across the years that weirdly have contributed, like, because he actually did contribute like an important goal there. Like, I always think back to Simone Sassa scoring that goal against Napoli that one season, where like that was the biggest moment of his career, and then he was out of Juventus the next season. But it's just like, it's crazy how many like random guys have made contributions to keep the streak going.
It is very much a who's, especially those early years where you had Beppe Marotta with the random loan deals and co-ownership and everything. Is very much a who's who of remember that guy. So, as I said, two games to talk about this week, and we will start off kind of comparing, contrasting, I guess, the not so good and the pretty good. And I'll start with Sergio, since he, in his grab bag this week, I think he had a really good comparison for the Dynamo game, is that it was very Allegri-like in the fact of how Juventus, to steal a line from Chucks, managed the game. And also just kind of the overall performance, where it wasn't great, but it wasn't so terrible either. And since Sergio is one to embrace Juventus Conspiracy Corner, as one of our loyal commenters, Del Piero's girl, mentioned in the comments in the game thread, did Juventus dress like Dynamo Kiev's arch rival Shakhtar Donetsk with the orange uniforms to throw them off their game? Sergio, what say you?
I mean, why not? I always love the Conspiracy Corner. Plus, Shakhtar Donetsk, like, noted powerhouse Shakhtar Donetsk, who just beat Real Madrid 3-2.
That's right.
Like, earlier today. So, you know, maybe we got some mojo there for them. But yeah, for sure. I mean, it was all the time while I was watching the game, I was thinking, like, this is a very much, like, 2016 performance from Juventus, which is just, like, nothing too flashy, just overall – I don't want to say dominating, because it's not dominating, just like in control. Like, Dynamo Kiev at no point ever looked like they were going to threaten the goal, Juventus goal. You know, they kind of really managed the game very well. And they had a few chances in the first half. They obviously, you know, scored two in the second half. And unlike we've seen in other matches, even this season, but especially last season, they never looked like they were in danger of like losing that lead. Like, again, you know, Dynamo Kiev is not the top of the cream there in the Champions League. But still, I think they're a better team than Crotone, for example. And Crotone actually, you know, they had a lot of dangerous chances. Like, it wasn't, you know, it's not the same case exactly, because, you know, Juventus were a man down against Crotone. But still, it was encouraging to see, because even though it wasn't as flashy, for example, again, like the Sampdoria win that started the season, it was a much more just controlled, they controlled the pace of the game, they controlled how the game went. When they wanted to go back and cede the possession to Dynamo Kiev, as they did in the last few minutes, they did that. And when they wanted to have the possession and go forward, they did that as well. So it was just overall a very good win, I would say, at a tricky, you know, place to go play, especially after the Crotone game, which was a bit of a letdown, you know. So yeah, I think very, very workmanlike, very, very Max Allegri to me. That's kind of how it would resume, you know, that game.
Yeah, I do agree overall with you, Sergio. I think it was definitely not a spectacular win against Dynamo Kiev. I think Dynamo Kiev did have some spells where they caught some momentum and they did have some attacking moves that looked promising. And then, you know, they'll lose the ball, but then they'll kind of get it back again quickly and then put another attack. You know, that type of like attacking momentum where it's like, Juve keep losing the ball. And then, man, they keep losing the ball like this and it's only 1-0. Like at the time, it was only 1-0. You know, you feel a little bit like, okay, one mistake could mess up the game. And that's the thing about, you know, 1-0 games, like especially 1-0 away games at places like Dynamo Kiev. It's like, okay, you can be in control of the match and be a goal ahead, but all it takes is one freak instant, one deflected free kick that lands at the, you know, feet of the striker, and then it just gets banged in and it's an equalizer. So I was still a little wary of that until Morata's second goal. Then I was, you know, at ease. But still, when we were 1-0 ahead, I was not entirely at ease. Plus, I thought the first half was not particularly good. I mean, you know, at the end of the day, okay, we didn't concede. Well, okay, we didn't concede. But then we also didn't concede really clear-cut opportunities against Dynamo Kiev. I mean, I think Chesney had that one save late in the second half, later-ish in the second half, from a pretty decent shot from, I obviously forget which player it was. But yeah, I mean, Chesney didn't have really anything to do. So in terms of clear-cut opportunities, okay, that was good. We didn't really concede any ground there. But in terms of, you know, a few opportunities, few bits of momentum that we did kind of let them, we gave them a bit too much hope sometimes. Like, oh, okay, it's only 1-0. Hey, if we keep going and like keep just string a few passes together, we could maybe carve something out here. So, you know, I wasn't overly pleased with that. But at the end of the day, it was definitely an improvement from the Coton game. Overall, pretty well managed game. But, you know, I'm not like over the moon, like, oh, great, now all the issues from Coton and Roma are resolved. There are still definitely issues to resolve. And, you know, definitely still work to be done. But overall, like, just a cautious satisfaction with the Kiev game. And, you know, off to Barcelona we go.
What is that? Some optimism from Chucks? Oh,
cautious. Cautious. Don't play your hand, Mr. Penza.
Oh, boy. Oh, boy. First off, it was that shot that you were talking about that Chesney saved towards the end. That was Sergei Sidorchuk.
Oh, look at you showing off.
Actually, really.
Say that three times.
That was a really nice. Yeah. That was actually a really good save by Chesney too. I'm actually with you on this one, Chucks. There was, I mean, for the most part, the game really was under control, but there was a period of about 15 minutes from about the 70th minute up until Morata scored where I was really starting to get uneasy. Whereas when we were up 1-0 before we added the last two goals against Sampdoria, at which point I never really felt like the lead was in danger, those 15 minutes where we really started to bend a little bit, that had me worried and had me thinking we need this second goal, which duly came, thankfully. But to that effect, what you said, Sergio, about this being Allegri-like, I think it was very Allegri-like in the fact that the team started to drop back a little bit way too early, which is something that that I hope doesn't become a habit. The biggest thing to me about the game was the way that the attack kind of, it didn't flow very well. It was a little bit chaotic. You know, you had guys, especially the midfielders. Rabiot was more guilty of this than Bentancur, but Bentancur did his fair share of this too. Just kind of spraying passes that were not necessarily precise and, you know, would give the ball away. And then they'd recover, you know, somebody would recover, like Rabiot seemed like he was recovering a ball every 5 minutes, and then do the exact same thing. And there were a couple of times where two or even three different players were attacking the same space. And that just killed a move because all of a sudden you're in way too much traffic. Obviously, that's the kind of thing that you hope will iron out with time, because again, we're looking at a situation where Pirlo had one friendly to start installing things. This is still very much in the forming phase, but it's something that you want to look for improvement on later, because, you know, some of those giveaways, passing giveaways, if we had been playing Barcelona on Tuesday, would have been punished, and punished hard. But overall, I thought that it was, I used the phrase in my recap, workmanlike, a very workmanlike win, a good way to start Pirlo's Champions League career off. And I am like, I challenge every person who was doubting Alvaro Morata and saying that, and lamenting the fact that we didn't get Dzeko or Suarez, to line up for your crow, because Alvaro Morata he's happy. He looks pretty confident right now. And I think he's just deliriously happy to be back at Juventus, and he can lead. And it's looking like he can lead this line if he needs to. And, you know, we were talking when he was signed about how, you know, he was signed not being expected to be the man, but he's also showing right now that it looked like if he needs to be, he could be the man. And I think that that's great. These last two games have been a real joy watching him play, and all of a sudden just start looking like he was that peak of form, like in the beginning of his end of his first season, beginning of his second with Juve. That front line, you know, Hunter said it early, that attacking front that we have, any combination that we can throw up there is going to be scary if they get the right service. And Morata's just proving that over and over.
Man, those are ambitious words there about Morata. Hope you don't get crucified in the comments for that. Which, you know, everybody's always looking for a good fight, a sparring battle with people.
I welcome it.
They didn't come after you for your cat. So, you know,
my cat doesn't score.
Well, the cat's a lot cuter than me.
My cat doesn't score goals in the Ukraine. So in cold Ukraine. But no, on Morata's note, on that note about Morata, rather. Yeah. I mean, I think it is very good to have the actual number nine. I mean, we had Higuain, of course, but with Higuain leaving, and I said this, I think, in a preseason kind of discussion, I said that Morata was indeed going to be one of the more important players at the front line, because he's really the only center forward we have, like, emphasis on center forward. You know, he's really the only one that's like, you know, he's going to put in headers. And I mean, Ronaldo as well, but like, he's the only one that's going to be really specifically at the end of crosses and really going to be in the box and, you know, doing number nine stuff. I mean, that said, I still a little reluctant to consider Morata like a player that will carry a team. I don't think he will like necessarily carry a team very much. I mean, but then again, that's why you have like Ronaldo and Dybala and stuff. Like, they'll create that type of magic and that kind of more initiative, and Morata hopefully will be on the end of it, you know. But yeah, I mean, to kind of go back to something you said about, at some point there were like multiple players in the same space or like attacking the same space. So actually, it's funny. I actually didn't see, I only saw parts of the game because A, my stream was bad, and B, could you believe it? They were showing Zenit against Club Brugge on TV instead of the Juve game. Can you believe that? I was absolutely infuriated. I was like, are you serious?
CBS did not cover themselves in glory on the stream. Like, the Juve stream didn't show up. A link to the Juve stream didn't show up on CBS All Access until like 5 minutes into the game. They did not cover themselves in glory starting their Champions League coverage off.
Oh man, I was furious, man. But anyway, so you know, I listened to what is actually pretty nice. It's the UEFA radio commentary, basically, which is honestly is very good. It kind of brings you back to the days of, if we are of that age, but of listening to radio. And it is quite nice, you know, listening to sports radio commentary. It's a very different experience, and it's Yeah, I do really recommend it. Just kind of try listening to the radio commentary of a game once. But anyway, the commentator, I think it was Andy Brassel, which that's such a great name, Andy Brassel. If you're listening, Andy, you're the man. But he mentioned something that when Dybala came on, that him and Ramsey were essentially playing in that same space of like just kind of sort of ish in a Tec Batista position, which even though like Ramsey wasn't really supposed to. And yeah, you know, I don't know if that was just one instance. And, you know, Brassel, he was saying this, he said, you know, he wasn't sure if that was just one instance or if that was just kind of tactical miscommunication where Ramsey didn't realize, okay, you're supposed to be kind of central midfield now and let Dybala run that space behind Morata and just behind the front line. But yeah, what you said there, that just reminded me of that, you know, that kind of duplication there of like, hey, you guys are attacking the same space. But yeah, I mean, overall, I think it was like just a pragmatic victory. Although I'm just always faced with that dilemma of like, you know, you mentioned, okay, we sat back too early. It's always that dilemma of, okay, you're 1-0 ahead. If you go forward in search of a second goal, you might look naive or like too gung-ho in like going forward. But then again, if you sit back, you're just kind of inviting, like that lack of urgency is just inviting the opposition to be like, well, it's only one goal, so why not try go for it? And I don't know, I never really know what, like I can see both sides of criticism, and I don't know, I can never really decide on what point to do, but yeah, I mean, I see the annoyance with sitting back too much and too early, but then again, I can also see people being annoyed with like, you know, if you're 1-0 ahead, throwing six men forward in attack and just like, you know, leaving the defense out to dry.
Well, that was one of the things under Sarri, correct? Where he basically said, we don't want to kind of sit on a 1-0. We want more goals. And obviously,
yeah,
more goals attempted to be scored led to more goals being allowed.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I think it's one of those things that's definitely like 2020, you know, hindsight, because it's like if they go full in for the attack and they get another goal, then they're like, oh, they're a relentless team. Like they'll just go right for the neck. And if they drop back and they actually keep the lead, then they're like a super defensive team. Like they know how to manage a game and manage a lead. But, you know, if the opposite happens, like then they get crucified. You know, I think it's one of those things that you have to know what you have in your team. And to me, I think that the moment they kind of like gave the initiative back to Dinamo, I think it was good. I think it was well, and it actually ended up working because they get that second goal on that counterattack after they gave kind of like Dinamo Kiev a little bit of more of like leeway. So, you know, but we could also be, you know, sitting here and talking about, you know, oh, they allowed the goal and now we're like back from Kiev with a tie and, you know, sound the alarms. So it's always kind of like one of those things that it definitely depends on the results, but overall, I think they played a good game. And you know, just kind of like, if you want to finish this conversation about streams, there's a lot of bad things about living in Latin America, I will say that. But there's one really great thing, and that is that every single Champions League game is like broadcasted either on ESPN Deportes or in Fox Sports Latin America. Every single, like you'd never miss a game. Like it's the best thing. That's awesome. So you don't really have to rely on body streams or whether or not CBS decides that, you know, another game's more important. So that's great. That's peak stuff. That's why I hardly ever miss a game because of that.
You know, it's funny. I actually read about that, I think Facebook got the rights for Copa Libertadores games, if I'm not mistaken. And they're streaming all the games. And like, it really pissed a lot of people off because like internet streams aren't reliable, like as reliable there as they are, you know, in like Europe and US and stuff. And it like really annoyed a lot of people.
Not only do they do that, they have like Facebook actually has the rights for like a handful of Champions League matches. Mm. So for example, today they had Atletico against Bayern Munich with what a walloping that was, but they actually broadcasted that through Facebook, which is like, I mean, you're just going to see football all over here in Latin America, which is really nice, at least for me.
At least for me. He's the only one who lives in Latin America.
Yeah, I mean, I'm assuming they do it for me exclusively. So, you know, I'm happy they do that.
Obviously, one of the big things that we're waiting on ahead of the Barcelona game is to whether Cristiano Ronaldo will actually be available. As of recording, we haven't heard anything in terms of a negative, or, you know, he's still positive. But at least for now, we'll assume that there's no Ronaldo, since we haven't heard anything to the contrary. But how are you guys feeling knowing that Barcelona beat our favorite Ferencváros? How did I do with that, Chucks? Did I do okay?
Try again.
Try again? I'm not going to try again. But Barcelona got a pretty convincing win on the first day of their group stage. And then, obviously, Juventus did what they did in Ukraine. But how are we feeling going into, obviously, the first big, big game of this season, knowing that Juventus injuries, COVID, whatever, are probably not going to be full strength unless we suddenly hear something from Juventus within like the next 24 hours or so?
It's going to be very interesting. I mean, having Barcelona having to dip into their center back depth a little bit for this game is going to be interesting on the other side, because Gerard Piqué got sent off for a really stupid foul that was totally unnecessary. But if there's one place where Barca really does kind of get shaky, it is as you go down that center back depth chart. Morata, Dybala, I'm assuming Dybala will end up starting that game, but, you know, anybody else that's in attack, that's going to be a place to target. But I think Juve is going to have to be, if you want to come out of that game with a win, pragmatism is going to have to be the rule here. Because I do think that, you know, Barcelona are far closer to full strength. Lionel Messi exists. And this teenage kid of theirs, Fati, right?
Ansu Fati
is extraordinary. Like, this, we're kind of looking at Mbappe 2.0 with this guy, and he's going to be difficult to contain. It's actually a little upsetting. I mean, as the days and the games go by, I find myself wondering more and more where the heck Alexandro is, because I'd like to have him out there for defensive purposes out on the wing in a game like this. Because I don't necessarily trust Juan and Chiesa as wingbacks in a scenario against Barcelona, even a Barcelona that's a lot less stable than it has been in the past. This is going to be a tough one. I wouldn't mind just coming out with a draw, to be totally honest. I think this is going to be a more, you know, and it's hysterical, because last week here we were talking about how close run these games were going to be, and then the Ronaldo COVID news broke a day or two after we recorded, and it really did change the paradigm a little bit, because, you know, with Ronaldo out, with McKennie out, which really disrupts the midfield depth, that's a depleted squad going in. And, you know, Chiellini out now, most likely until after the next international break. It's going to take some work to get a result out of this match. And to steal Chucks's pessimism, I'm not necessarily expecting much out of this one, to be totally honest with you.
Yes, enter the darkness. Embrace the darkness. Yes.
They have cookies.
Darkness is the heart's true essence. If someone can tell me from what game that is, I would be very impressed. No, actually, I'm slightly-ish more optimistic, just because I did read, I didn't watch the Barcelona Ferencváros game. I don't know. I'm just showing off now. I don't know if that even makes sense, but...
Come on.
I did read some of the commentary and the match analysis of that game. And I heard that Barca were a little shaky, actually, against that team. I heard that, I think they, at 2-1 or 3-1, at a point, they hit the bar, Ferencváros, they hit the bar once or twice, I think. And basically, they were close to equalizing. And they really did give them a bit of a scare, and then, you know, they scored 3-1, 4-1, 5-1, and yeah, well, then it was over. And of course, that penalty that, you know, was given away that Piqué was forced into, that was another threatening moment. So, you know, I heard that they really did give away some threatening, a lot of opportunities to Ferencváros. And, you know, I think, plus the fact that Piqué is suspended, that's, you know, another thing there. And at the end of the day, like I said, I think 2 episodes ago or so, these are 2 teams in transition. And given that they're, you know, Juventus and Barcelona, and that just means that it's really quite unpredictable. We still don't really know what Juve's, or well, what Pirlo's best 11 is and what Pirlo's best system is. And I'm pretty sure that Koeman doesn't know the same thing with his team at this point. So I think just with that unpredictability, with that uncertainty, it's a toss-up, really. And I personally, I don't expect Ronaldo to make it. I don't, you know, like I said, I haven't heard anything either from the news. And I think it would be an extraordinarily tight squeeze if he could, you know, if he were to make it. And I don't expect him to make it. However, on the point of Dybala, though, so I'm thinking, okay, if he starts, who's going to have to be dropped then? Because Chiesa's suspended for the Serie A game. So then is Pirlo then in the spirit of rotation going to play Chiesa in a Champions League, and then obviously he's suspended for the Serie A game, so then play Dybala against Hellas Verona, but then, or does he just, you know, leave Chiesa for a Champions League game after he was very impressive in his 2 games that he's played so far? Plus, I mean, who do you drop, you know, if you put in Dybala, who do you drop to still maintain balance? Defensive and offensive balance. I mean, you can't really drop Morata, because that just, I mean, then you're playing a false nine. And I mean, I don't know, unless he finds that an efficient system to play. So I'm just struggling to think, like, okay, if he plays Dybala, like, who does he drop then? So I frankly, I have no idea. But nevertheless, I'm, you know, I just think that obviously Barca are there for the taking, but Juve sort of are there for the taking as well, just because of, you know, the transition that both of us are going through. And of course, shocker, Chiellini's injured. But I heard it was not as serious an injury as first feared, but I personally, I'm starting to fear for his career in general.
Yeah, I actually have to amend my own statement, because I was just clicking through some news, and it looks like he might only be out for about 2 weeks, which is different than the last thing that I read before then. But I'm like you, I kind of think, if things continue this way, where he, you know, plays a game or two and then has to spend a couple of weeks recovering, I think he might, he's a smart enough man to know when the game is up, and I think he might start thinking about moving on at the end of this season if this keeps up. I kind of hope he does, because he'd go out with a lot more dignity that way.
Yeah, I mentioned it in today's article that just went up, actually. Yeah, I think at this point, as much as we don't like to admit it, just because he's been such a big part of the club for so long, but I think officially it's time to kind of like stop really relying on Chiellini, you know, because we all know that when he's fit, he's really good, but that has been like, he's almost never fit. So that's a problem. But at this point, I think you have to realistically look at it and say, look, we're going to go into a season with Bonucci, Demiral, and De Ligt, and those are going to be our guys. And if Chiellini can give us some, you know, games here and there, that's gravy. But I think at this point, those are kind of like your 3 center backs that are going to be like the ones that really are going to, you know, be the anchor of the defense going forward. But, you know, going back to the Barcelona game, here's the thing, shocker. I'm actually quite optimistic, because I agree 100% with Chucks. I did see parts of the game with against Frank Bars, and they were honestly pretty susceptible. Like, they were not, the first 20 minutes or so, obviously Barcelona is a better team, but it wasn't like they were just steamrolling them. Like Chuck said, they had a few chances throughout the game. Obviously they go down, and then, you know, the floodgates kind of break open, but it wasn't super impressive to me what I saw from Barcelona, especially against the actual weakest team in the group. I think Juventus looked better against Kiev than Barcelona looked against Ferencváros at times, despite the final scoreline. not only that, but it actually lost against Getafe, which is, again, not really a powerhouse during the weekend. At this moment, as we speak, if you're a betting man, Juventus is favored, slightly favored over Barcelona. So, I mean, I don't think it's out of the question to expect a win. I wouldn't bet on it, actually. I wouldn't bet on it. I'm not sure it's going to happen, but I wouldn't be surprised if it did because, you know, both teams are in transition. You know, they both kind of have weak spots, but the latest we have seen of each team, I'd be a little bit more, you know, optimistic about Juventus' probabilities to get a win in this game. And they're at home. So, I mean, they should go for the win because they are at home just because of that. So I don't know. I think I'm pretty optimistic. Piqué's out. You know, I mean, everyone has their take about Piqué, about whether or not it's actually better for Barcelona not to have them and all of that. But I mean, he's still their, you know, their starting center back, their leader in that defense. I mean, I think, you know, whatever your opinion of the guy is, the team is probably better with him. So I think if I had to make a prediction, I think they're going to win. I hope they win. I think they have a good chance of winning, especially with how the team is playing right now. And if they somehow get Cristiano Ronaldo back, that's going to be huge. So especially for the comment section and for, you know, the overall football Twitter world that is going to get another Messi Ronaldo showdown. So I feel weirdly more confident going into this game after what we saw against Kiev than, you know, before the game on Tuesday.
Don't turn our comments section into craziness again, Sergio.
Yeah, we've already had enough of that lately, haven't we?
Oh, I will. The my article is just going to be like, who's better, Messi or Ronaldo? And it's just going to be that for 2,000.
Yeah, well,
words.
You'd better be picking up your slack on the mob duty then.
you're going to be handing out the punishment that day.
I had no idea I could do that, to be honest. Like, I had no idea that was something.
Lucky you.
I mean, if people were as passionate about, like, I don't know, global warming or something as they are about, you know,
ignorance is bliss, right?
Yeah, I was just, like, watching the comments. I was like, oh, that's nuts. Okay. And I was just crawled past because I had no idea that I could do anything about it. So,
shall we jump into our hordes of Twitter questions, gentlemen?
Guide us.
All right. As I promised on the Twitter machine when we first got a few questions from @LucaCharms, Sergio, is it possible that the orange kits are good, actually?
No, actually. here's what I'll say about the orange kits. And this is a trend. This is just a theory of mine. I have nothing to back this up. But I think that as a whole, like for Adidas, the strategy this year was to have like the third kit to be like a more like a kit that is designed to be worn like not on the pitch, like for fans to buy it and use it like in the street with like a pair of jeans or something. Like, because when you look at them individually and you think of them like, oh, I could use that with like, I don't know, like a jacket or something and wear it out on the street to a bar, it makes more sense to me, especially like the Man United kits and the Arsenal kits and all the third kits from Adidas. That is my theory. And if you think about it that way, it's kind of not that bad. But since we're not talking about it that way and we're just thinking about like how they look on the pitch, they look awful. It looks like Juventus is celebrating Halloween every single day. And right now it kind of flies because it is October, but you know, once they start wearing them in like February, it's going to look even worse. I still hate them. I will still get it when it's like $15 on the clearance rack, though. I will do that. That is going to happen.
It's better on the field than it looked in the mock-ups. But unlike the primary kit, that's not saying much in this case. Like, the primary kit actually looked like, I hated the mock-ups for it, but it actually looks really good. This one, the mock-ups were awful. This one, slightly less awful.
Honestly, maybe if they didn't go with the full orange look, it might be better. Like, it just, they look like pumpkins out there, and it's just, it's a bummer. And especially with how cool the away kit is, and they haven't, like, I don't think they've used it yet during the season. And that one is so cool. Like, that one is so clean. Like, it looks awesome. And they go out and trot out the orange thing. Like, I don't get it. But yeah, to summarize, no, that they're terrible.
I will say this: the sneakerhead part of my brain, as you mentioned, Sergio, it's something to do with off the field, and the third kit definitely matches the Juventus branded Adidas Ultra Boosts that they have, which are orange and black. So, as you mentioned, it's definitely something more, I would assume, more for the off the field.
Yeah, like outfit. Fan for the fans to wear. I think that's what they were going for.
It's sure as heck better than this like designer one time only kit that has been popping up that they're gonna use. I don't know when, like the washed out watercolor of the old pink Jeep kit that Pharrell Williams has put out. That like is like the this year's answer to the Palace kits from last year that were actually kind of cool. This one looks like a child spilled water on a watercolor painting, and it's like,
I'm assuming that one, like, they're not gonna wear that on the pitch. Like, I mean, if they use it, they're just gonna like sell it for like for you to wear in the streets. That I don't know if I would use it on the streets, but I mean, I think that's the.
No, they wore the Palace kit last year.
Yeah, but the Palace kit was like normal. I mean, like that kind of looked like a kit, like a normal kit. I don't know if they'd wear this one, but yeah, it's terrible. By the way, that one's terrible also. Yeah, so I mean,
it's awful.
In case anyone wants to ask that question later on, that one sucks too.
That's coming from a man who spent a lot of his quarantine assembling a collection of not so great kits, correct?
Obscure, weird kits for mostly defunct teams or close to defunct teams. Yes.
You have one of Ferencváros.
Hey, if anyone has the link up, I definitely buy one from Ferencváros. No problem.
From at Link Av Capital, who is your most surprising player so far, and who is your most disappointing player so far?
Most surprising has to be Danilo.
Second that.
Like, did anybody think that Danilo would turn out to be like an ace level back three center back through the first five games of the year? As for most disappointing, it's hard to say right now, because there hasn't been a whole ton of really awful, like a string of really, really awful, real awfulness yet. If you want to say, I mean, maybe you could say it's just the fact that Dybala hasn't been fit enough to make the field yet has been disappointing. But other than that, I personally don't really have one player yet that is a huge letdown at this point in the season for me. That'll change. But yeah, right now I can't really think of anybody that I would really point the finger at in that way.
Yeah, second that. I mean, I 100% second the Danilo assessment. He's just been extremely, extremely surprising. I mean, most of us have kind of thrown in the towel with him, but I mean, he's good. He's been very good as a right center back, kind of, just kind of in a Lichtsteiner type of way of being actually a right back, but then being still very good at center back and being able to slide out of that right center back into right back as needed during the game and really giving you that tactical flexibility to do so. I really wonder what has been behind just that positive run for him. I mean, it's just interesting. I wonder what tactically helped from being not just a right center back, but then being in a three-man back line. What about that tactically suited him so much and like just brought out such good performances in him? I truly don't know. I have no idea, but whatever it is, it's worked perfectly so far, of course. In terms of the most disappointing, I guess by virtue of his absence, or apparent absence, Federico Bernardeschi, I think he's suffered quite the, unfortunate fall from grace. It's a real, real shame. But I still believe he's got something. I still believe he has some use to this team, but he's running out of time.
get you someone that believes in Bernardeschi as much as Chuck still believe in him, because I'm
this dumb. Love ain't for free, man. This love ain't
for free. Sure, man. I'm just as much as I want to believe like Chuck's does, that like I think I'm out. I'm leaving that island. But yeah, just to reiterate, I agree 100% with everything you guys said about Danilo. And disappointing, I am kind of disappointed in Adrien Rabiot so far. Not because he has been terrible, because he hasn't. He's been okay. But considering like the performances he was putting like at the end of last season, I really thought he would kind of like hit the ground running and kind of like keep up those performances and really be kind of like that linchpin in the midfield. That hasn't quite happened. Again, he hasn't been bad. He definitely hasn't been bad, but I don't think he's been as good as we expected him to be. And that'd be my mild disappointment. Outside of that, I agree with all of the things you said. So far, nothing has been really outright terrible.
From at DJ Abides, there is something very inspired about Chiesa's play that I do not see in many others on the squad. Sure, we're only two games in, but things seem very hopeful. What are your initial thoughts on how he will influence the attack and the team overall? We're having fun with small sample sizes today, by the way, folks. Fun with small sample sizes.
Yeah, true. It reminds me of something I read from a book, Thinking Fast and Slow, by Daniel Kahneman, the Nobel Prize winner. He said something about him and Emil Tversky, his late research partner. He said, too many people believe in the law of small numbers, which is the erroneous belief that the law of large numbers applies to small numbers as well. So I thought that was a clever little way of putting it. No, I think Chiesa brings just a real directness in, like, a verticality in his type of play. I mean, he just takes players on. He's kind of like, he's just... I mean, him and Kulusevski are like bring that kind of directness, and Kulusevski brings more that. I mean, he's a bigger lad, and he's just a stockier guy, so you know he has that physicality in addition to his directness. But I think that's really just the thing. Like when I look at those two players, but Chiesa especially, it's just that real directness. Like he will take players on. You know, someone like Dybala will try and like you know pass around or like. A little flick here and there, which is obviously useful, but it's useful to have that variety of attacking options, to have, you know, a foot on the ball playmaker, to have a actual number nine, a center forward, and to have a player out and out winger that will just take players on directly. I think Douglas Costa was kind of supposed to be that type of player as well. I think he was, but he just couldn't stay fit. That's this issue there. But I'm pretty optimistic about Chiesa, and so far so good. I mean, two really good games, and an unfortunate red card. I think that, an unfortunate red card. But yeah, I think he gives Pirlo just a range of options, a variety of options in attack. That adds a dimension of unpredictability to the team. So you have one player that can take people on, one that can run them behind, one that can play the through ball, one that can finish it. So that's a good diversity of skills there.
I'm kind of surprised at how well he seems to be taking to the wingback spots. It wasn't quite something that I was expecting, but he's turned in some really good performances, not like the most skilled of defenders, but he's got the energy there to make up for it. And you know, when he bombs forward and gets the ball in, like that cross to Morata for the goal against Crotone was a peach. Just one first touch bullet across for Morata to just tap home. If he does more of that and a little less of the kind of dancing around on the wing that we saw towards the end of the Kiev game, when he started getting a little too cute, there'll be some really good service coming out of whichever side he's on. As long as he doesn't start messing up defensively, I think that that's a really, really good spot for him all of a sudden, which is a bit of a surprise for me, and I'm happy I'm wrong on that one.
From at @Jabari_Samuel, with a fully fit squad and with all the tinkering in defense, is Bonucci still a starter once De Ligt is back and Demiral, or as they refer to him, the Turkish wall continued to progress. And let us say the caveat, as Sergio likes to say, very much has to do with Giorgio Chiellini's health, I would assume.
Yeah, I think it has to do with Chiellini's health because, you know, if he's out, you know, right now it's like you mentioned, 2 weeks. But, I mean, that's going to keep happening, unfortunately. I think that's the point in his career he's currently at. But I still think Bonucci has a spot because has to be kind of like the anchor of this defense. And it doesn't – he's the veteran presence. He's the guy who knows how to play in that kind of like three-man back line type of set. And most importantly, he's kind of like the only one that's that ball-playing center back that De Ligt and Demiral at this point in their career are just not – you know, we don't know if they're going to develop like that maybe later on. But at this point in their career, they're not kind of like that center back that can go with the ball on their feet and make a play and kind of like open up the rival that way. They're just not that right now. And if Pirlo is going to keep playing that three-man back line, I think you still need to have a guy like Bonucci there kind of like anchoring that line. Now, with that being said, if, you know, by whatever it is, they end up being in another, you know, in another lineup, they end up doing another setup, then who knows, right? And Bonucci at this point, he's a 34-year-old guy, you know, with Demiral and De Ligt like nipping at the heels of the veterans. I mean, you have to assume his cycle is, you know, it's kind of like on their last breath there. But definitely, I think at least for this season, I think Bonucci will still be kind of like the number one center back option unless something drastically changes.
I think that it's an interesting question as to what do you do with Danilo if he keeps playing at this level in that back three and then De Ligt gets back? Does he, you know, do you move him back out to the wing back spots and he becomes depth there? Or do you leave him where he is, where he's playing really well? And it really, you know, I know I said this in my match recap. When the starting lineup came out and I realized that Giorgio Chiellini was playing in the center of the back three as opposed to where Bonucci always has been, that was a bit of a surprise to me. And as much as it definitely had a tactical component, because it meant that, you know, switching into that back, that 4-4-2 that they would switch into in defense was a lot easier with Danilo on the left, then he could slot right into the back roll and Cuadrado could drop back in. Danny, we had mentioned that, you know, that little move he likes to do that never works when people are coming through the middle. It made me start wondering if Pirlo also wanted something not that in the center of that back of the line if you're defending a counter or something like that. Yeah, because Bonucci certainly hasn't been particularly strong in that center position so far this year. You know, there have been a couple of plays where you just look at him and it's just timid. I wonder about that. I wonder if there was a bit of a reaction to Bonucci's performance. And like I said, if Danilo keeps on playing like this, it's gonna be hard to drop him.
From at @Nico_Diamato, do you think that any three of Chiesa, Ronaldo, Dybala, and Kulusevski can coexist on the pitch together? They all seem to demand too much of the ball, even just with Kulusevski and Chiesa has seemed to overwhelm.
I think at least for Pirlo, that's going to be a big, big question. And you know, Chiesa being able to play on the left as he played against Kiev, it really does open up a lot more possibilities, because once the signing of Chiesa was complete, we all assumed he was going to be lining up on the right. If he can line up on the left and actually do a good job there, that kind of opens up a little bit what they can do, and they could kind of fit in Chiesa on the left with Ronaldo, Dybala, and Kulusevski in whatever, you know, order, kind of like free-flowing form you want, you know, leading the attack, if they can somehow manage to do that. But again, we're making a lot of assumptions because we don't know if Ronaldo is going to be able to play up top. He has always kind of like rather play on the wing. is he actually going to play up front, which a lot of people have been clamoring for him to do at this point in his career? Can you do that without an actual, like, out-and-out number nine? You know, Morata doesn't really fit that lineup. And can Kulusevski really be productive, like, in that hole, in that number 10 spot? Can Dybala be effective as a second striker? I think he can, but, you know, he hasn't really played all that much at that position since he probably came to Juventus a few years ago now. So there's a lot of things in the air. And right now, especially with the way Pirlo has been playing, which has been overall pretty, like, free-flowing, not really, like, the positions are not, like, set in stones. I'm assuming he's going to want to try to fit in as much talent as he can on the field. But if he can somehow manage to fit in all of those guys and maybe fit in a Juan Cuadrado on the right, maybe, or if Federico Bernardeschi has his, you know, career revival, as Chuck is hoping, on the right, you know, maybe, you know, you have so much talent on the field, it's going to be really, really cool and interesting to see. But, you know, that's going to be it. If he can do that, and if he can do that effectively, then that changes the whole outlook of the season, I think. But in my opinion, that's going to be the biggest challenge for Pirlo, how to fit all the pieces he has in a way that makes sense, that doesn't lose his balance, that doesn't lose balance in the squad, and that overall works. And I think that's going to be his biggest challenge for the season.
Yeah, I think this is really a question of just it's frankly a question of temptation for Pirlo. Like, is he going to be tempted to squeeze in? I think I said this after the Roma game, I think it was. How much is he going to be able to resist the temptation to just throw all your best pieces onto the pitch and then just kind of say, okay, let me just put him there and there and then there. You know, put Juan Cuadrado on the left and then I can put Kulusevski on the right and then I can put, you know, Morata and Ronaldo. Like, resisting that temptation to try and put all your best players on the pitch at the same time and rather just accomplishing balance. So having a player or two that can take people on directly, okay, and then another one that can run in behind the defense, and then another one that can, like, actually finish the play, like Morata, and a foot on a ball player maker, but then also obviously two central midfielders that actually kind of keep things tight. So it's really going to be just about the balance, and I really hope that Pirlo is not going to be like, well, you know what, I have all this talent, let me just throw them all on and tell them to figure it out. I mean, that'll be A, very anarchic, and B, just, I think, indisciplined and just imbalanced. So, it remains to be seen. I mean, who knows? And plus, I think with so many games, given that we're playing so many games, I just think you want to rotate anyway. I mean, you know, we have like, what, 6-7 games in the next month anyway, so you want to rotate anyway. So, let's see what he does, you know.
It's reminded me a little bit of the kind of the way that the NBA has been trending a little bit with this idea of positionless basketball, especially with guys like Mike Budenholzer, the coach of the Milwaukee Bucks. Because if you read Pirlo's coaching thesis, he really does he puts much less importance on what position a player plays and more on, you know, where they are on the pitch, what they're doing within the system. And I think that's, you know, especially up front, is going to be an interesting experiment, because I do think that, you know, Pirlo's idea does kind of eschew those traditional, you know, the assigned numbers, the 9, the 10. And it's going to be very interesting to see if the team takes that kind of a concept, if I'm not reading this wrong, that takes that concept and runs with it, or takes that concept and runs into each other, like we were talking about before in the Kiev game in certain points. Like you said, Sergio, if it works, oh man, that's going to be fun to watch. But this is going to almost be a bit of an experiment in how the game is played, if what I'm thinking Pirlo is kind of edging towards is what it is. It's certainly going to be really interesting to see how they can coexist all at the same time. I don't necessarily think that Kulusevski, you can bunch in Kulusevski as a guy that needs a lot of the ball. I mean, he had, I think, fewer than 20 touches in this game, but he was one of the most dangerous guys on the pitch for most of it, until he came off.
It was 19, I believe you said in your
recap. Yeah, 19. He touched the ball 19 times, but he put two shots on goal. He was the direct result of the first goal being scored. But that is, like you guys said, the question of the season. How does he get everybody working together? If he does it, this is a team that this year and in the years to come is going to go places.
You know, kind of as a last thought, it reminds me of when Ancelotti was in charge of Real Madrid, and somehow he managed to fit in like essentially three number 10s into one lineup and make it work. I mean, it was one of the most extraordinary. To me, tactically, I thought that was one of the most extraordinary.
It didn't exactly work.
Well, but that was the year that they won the Decimo. When Ancelotti, I remember when he played Kroos, James, and Isco in one lineup, and then he had two strikers. He played a 4-4-2 with them. I just kind of swear that was the year that they won the Decima.
No, I don't think so. Because I know that there was the first year that James was on Real Madrid was the year that we beat them in the semifinals, and he put James on as a midfielder, and that was a mess if they didn't have Luka Modric on the field, which Modric was hurt during that semifinal, which I think is one of the reasons that Juventus managed to get through in that tie, because there was no more balance once Modric was gone.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure they won it with Zinedine Zidane at the helm. I'm pretty sure, because my brother is a Real Madrid fan and he's pretty annoying about it, so I think I'm pretty sure that's how it went down.
No, hold on. No, I'm looking at it right now. Like, let's see. They beat Real Madrid. They beat Bayern Munich. And then they beat Atletico Madrid in the final 4-1 in extra time. Yeah. That was the year that he beat them in extra time. Yeah, in 2014 it was. Yeah, he won the Decima. And then Zidane won the other two after that. Yeah, I knew it was right, man. Yeah, I'm looking on the wiki page right now.
Okay.
Oh, you are correct. I stand corrected.
Yeah. As the great Donnie Brasco once said, of course I'm right. Wise guy's always right. Even when he's wrong, he's right.
I never doubted you, Chucks.
Yeah. Wise guy's always right.
Yeah. All right. On that note, we'll wrap things up here. I want to thank everybody, first and foremost, for their Twitter questions. We got by far, the most amount of questions for any single episode this week. Obviously, people were in a good mood because Juventus winning puts people in a good mood. So thank you very much, everybody, for the Twitter questions. Obviously, we only got to a small portion of them, but I believe we had 23 responses, which I can't remember ever getting half of that. So thank you very much for all of those questions, and hopefully next week we'll have another 20 something, because that would mean Juventus beat Barcelona. Anyways, you can follow us on social media at Juventus Nation on Twitter and on Facebook. You can like, subscribe, and rate us on Apple iTunes and Apple Podcasts. You can also listen to us on Spotify and Google Podcasts. Feel free to leave a review, all that good stuff. Rate us, give us 5 stars, boost our egos because they're not big enough already. So for Sam, for Sergio,
love us, for Sam, for Sergio,
and for Chucks, this is Danny saying thank you very much for listening. Stay safe out there, and we'll talk to you guys next time.